You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Today my guest is Isabel Allende, the author most recently of Paola, published by HarperCollins. She's the author as well of The House of the Spirits and The Infinite Plan and Eva Luna and Stories of Eva Luna and of Love and Shadows. But today, what she and I are going to be doing is part of a series entitled Imaging the Us, an exploration of autobiographical writings, which is a collaboration between Bookworm and the Getty Center for the History of Art and the Humanities. This collaboration looks at the relationship between autobiographical writings, memories, and the articulation of an us. Now, it seems like you're the ideal writer for this subject because so much family memory has gone into your work, and once it has been put in your work, it has become something like collective memory. Do you think that the individual stories of the Allendes and your grandparents are part of Chilean storytelling?
Oh, I wouldn't be so presumptuous, but but I think that those stories are very similar to the stories of other people in the same environment at the same time. We all, as a collective group, we experience the same historical events, political events. So in that way, maybe those stories are common to everybody. You know, it's very strange. Fiction is so powerful that when I wrote my first novel, The House of the Spirits, several of my relatives were very angry because they felt that I had betrayed the story of the family. But then they started reading the reviews, and and then they started playing the roles. And for some time, the official story of my family was that book, which is fiction. Then the movie came out, and the power of the fiction of the movie is so much greater than that of a book that now the photographs of Jeremy Irons and Meryl Streep are on the pianos of my relatives. Those are my real grandparents now.
So in other words, to some extent, fiction can become a part of memory.
Yes, I think that fiction tells history from beyond and behind. The real story is the story, not history.
You know what interested me very much? At the end of Paola, on the day of your daughter's death, you say that on that day, the veils that conceal reality were parted. And it seems to me that in your work, too, the ghosts and the presence of the past, the materialization of imaginative states, are all attempts to describe a reality that exists intangibly.
Yes.
At all times.
Yes. And somehow, when I write, I have the feeling that the stories are happening or will happen to some people. And through this tool that imagination is, I open a door or a veil or whatever, and I somehow can tap into those waves that carry those stories. And like a radio that tunes into the wave, I get it. I get the voices. I need a lot of silence and time to get it, but I do. Once I heard a sculptor saying that the statue is contained in the rock and his job is to take away what is not necessary, the leftovers, let's say. But the statue is already there. I feel that the story is there. And my job is to sort out the clutter and get to the essence of it.
Can you make a distinction between memory and imagination? Is that a meaningful distinction to you?
Both contaminate each other all the time. My imagination is often determined by my memories, because the person I am is my memory. is the addition of all the things that have passed in my life and those that I remember. Because maybe many things that were very important happened and I don't remember. They're not part of my memory. They're not part of myself. So in that way, memory influences imagination, and what I imagine is contaminated by my memory. But at the same time, when I write a memoir, when I remember, I use my imagination. Why do I want to remember only this thing and highlight this and write it in this order and not in another order? Why do I choose, let's say, chronological order? That's also an artificial form, the fact that I take events that happened in the blur of the past and I give them an order and highlight some and deny others or leave them in the shade. That is a very imaginative process.
You know, I once heard a Persian poet quoted. I'm not quite sure. I don't think it was Rumi, but the line was, "Go away, I want to remember you." Which
how wonderful! How wonderful!
The person who quoted this to me said, "This is all of memories of things past in a single sentence." But I wondered. It brings up the question: is exile, for instance, which you know you left Chile in, I believe, 1975. Is exile a necessary precondition? Exile of some sort. Death, divorce, departing, a necessary precondition to memory?
I don't know. In my case, it has been. I don't know if it works the same way for everybody. Maybe not. For me, all my writing comes from a very deep emotion, usually painful, that has been with me for a long time. And these memories that are painful live in me for some time. I internalize them, transform them, or digest them. And then something comes out that is fiction. And sometimes doesn't look even similar to the emotion that triggered it. But I know the source. I know where it comes from. The loss of my father when I was very young determined my feminism, determined the woman I am, determined my writing as a woman. The loss of my country made me a fiction writer. I needed to reconstruct a country that I had lost, rebuild memories that were being blurred more and more by time. I needed to resuscitate the people who had died, reunite the ones that had been scattered all over by the winds of exile and violence. So for me, if I remember something and I can write about it, I have lived it. If I do not write it, it never happened. Because in a very short time, it will be gone.
Can you describe, are there things that you remember in the process of writing? And can you describe how they come to you?
Writing is a very solitary pursuit. You spend many, many hours alone in silence. In any job, if you are in silence and alone, you will start remembering. We live our lives cluttered by noise, noise, noise. You come from New York. You know how much noise there is. We can't think. We can't tap into the past. We can't concentrate. We can't hear the voices because there's so much noise. But when you, like myself as a writer, have a job that forces you to be in silence, then the memories come. When I start writing, I start with an opening sentence that often comes from the gut, not from the mind. I just put my hands on the computer and start writing. And then I write a sentence that is a door that opens into a world that I have to explore. I have to be peeling layer by layer these things that hide reality from me in order to get to the story. Silence is what brings the memories back.
Then is there enunciation in sound? Because you have described the currents of air moving through your grandfather's house and voices coming to you both in dream and the voice of the grandmother from behind the drapery. Is memory an auditory medium primarily for you first?
Sometimes I have the feeling that the writing is, that I can hear the writing. When I write a sentence, I hear a voice. It's my voice or somebody's voice saying the sentence that I'm writing. But what comes first, the writing or the voice? I don't know. I can't tell.
I want to ask you a question I've never asked anyone. It's just occurring to me. I'm speaking, by the way, to Isabel Allende. We're talking about the subject of memory. And she's the author, most recently, of Paula, published by HarperCollins, which is a memoir of the death of her daughter. Who narrates your dreams?
Usually it's like a movie. Things happen in the dream without narration, but with action and dialogue like in a movie. However, sometimes I have heard the voice of my grandmother, the voice that I think is my grandmother's because I can't remember her voice, narrating something. I had a very revealing dream when Paula fell sick in the hospital in Madrid. And I heard the voice of my grandmother saying that Paula was dead. She had drank the potion of death. And I discarded the dream. I denied the dream. And then I had the same dream again when she died. And it was again the same voice that I think was my grandmother's voice. Now that Paula is not here anymore, sometimes in the dreams I hear her voice. But I can't say that she is the one who narrates the dreams.
I wondered whether you could describe to me the political effect of The House of the Spirits in South America when it came out. How was it taken? Because you were no longer living there and you were in exile. You were related to Allende. And the book, for some time, was regarded at first, before people had read it, as a political manifestation, as if what was going to be there would be a literal history of events.
Well, I think that some people were interested at the beginning, were interested in the book because of my name, the fact that I was Chilean. And still, at that time, in 1981, people remembered, had fresh memories of what had happened in Chile a few years before. Now 20 years have passed and few people know who Allende was. The book was forbidden in Chile at the beginning, but people smuggled copies into the country, photocopied them, and many people read it. And then later, when censorship was eliminated for books, only for books, they would sell it under the counter. You know, there's something very attractive in literature that is forbidden. It should always be forbidden, and people would read. Uh-huh. So the book became very popular, and it was a political statement in Chile at the time. In a way, it still is for many people, because still, somehow, the country is polarized. Although we have a democracy now, I could see that when we had the premiere of The House of the Spirits, the movie, and I was invited to Chile. No one had seen the movie yet. And the people who organized the premiere was a very glossy magazine, upper middle class. And they invited everybody that has any importance at all in Chile was invited, from the president to all the Congress, all the judiciary system, everybody that somebody was invited. And I could feel the atmosphere in the room frozen as the movie went on, because half the audience was not expecting to have a political statement on the screen. And some people walked out of the theater. They just couldn't take it. So it still is a political statement.
Now, I'm curious. You mentioned in Paula that not only many pictures of your father, that your father has been cut out of pictures in the family albums, but that pictures of Allende as well are valuable and no longer available. To what extent does writing replace that kind of pictorial memory in a society that has censored its records?
It is very important. I belong to a generation of Latin American writers that have been writing in exile for many years. There was a terrible decade of military dictatorships in Latin America from 1973 to 1983-85, more or less. It's still going on in some places, but that was the worst period. And at that time, all the intellectuals, all the writers from Latin America were living somewhere else. They couldn't live in their own countries or write in their own countries. So there was a literature of exile. And now we are beginning to see the literature of post-exile, of people who have returned to their countries to find that the reality is different, that in their memories they invented a country. I know that I have invented a Nerudian Chile. And when I go back and I confront the real Chile with the image I have of it, usually they are not similar. So now there is this new literature, post-exile, and very strange, it doesn't deal with political issues. It's a literature that doesn't care for social issues either. It's more intimist, more... There is a sort of disconnection from the process, from the political or social process of each country, which I think is a result, an obvious result, of the fact that these writers are disconnected, are detached from their language, from their roots, from their countries, from their... this feeling of belonging in a collective project that I had when I was young is no longer available for young writers.
Now, you've spoken of identifying and enjoying primarily the work of minority women writers.
Yes.
After that initial political project, is there a second one of a feminist project or a joining of, what would you call it, matrilineal narration?
Yes, yes. I would say that that is more important than the political aspects. The feeling that you can identify with those voices better than you can with most males. And also because in the United States, I find that most white male writers write about themes that I don't even know what they're talking about. I don't feel any connection, and I'm not really interested. For example, I see my husband reading these books about trials or thrillers or greed, or who cares? Or sports, who cares? Not connected at all.
Do you then feel, if we're talking about memory, that there is a gender of memory?
Really? I do think so. Because I don't know for the new generations, for my children or grandchildren, but in my generation, life was pretty segregated. We went to girls' schools, boys went to boys' schools. There were activities that boys did and girls didn't. We were brought up to be housewives and mothers mainly, and if we had a job, it was a kind of secondary job to help your husband go through the difficult years at the beginning, but you were not supposed to have a career, really. And there was a different culture around women. Issues that were only feminine. Problems that only women encountered. For example, children were a women's problem, a woman's problem, not men. Men were not involved, really. And if there was divorce, it was the women who took the children without discussion, even. So for my generation, this is a gender issue, too. Memory, what kind of memories do I have? If I could not write an autobiography, because an autobiography is about facts. It's about what you did and when and with whom, and to whom most of the time. A memoir, and this is what I have written, is very subjective. A memory is about feelings. It's about what you choose to remember. It's about relationships.
Well, there's a magnificent scene in Paola. I was very struck by it since I am an interviewer. People are at a table asking you what you intend to write next, what you'd be interested in. Is it easy to be funny? At the beginning of your career as a journalist, and you announce to the table, I would like to interview an unfaithful woman. And there's silence at the table. And it is true that the famous memoirs of infidelity, whether they are that of Emma Bovary or Anna Karenina, have been written by men.
Mm-hmm.
So do you feel, though, then, that when a literary critic says of a book, say by Virginia Woolf, that this is distinctly a woman's book, that this is a statement that is true?
I'm careful about that,
mm-hmm.
because literature is literature. We use the same tool, language. And the fact that we talk about literature written by women as if it was a separate genre, as if it was something that is somehow not as good as literature without adjectives, which is supposed to be written by men, I'm very careful about that, because I think that women should not segregate themselves, and therefore I never go to a women's writers' conference. But gender, like age, like place, determines the person you are, determines your biography, your sentiments, your perspective, your point of view about the world. Therefore, it determines the writing, the themes you choose, the things that you need to explore inside your own soul are quite different from those for a man or a woman. I have been struggling all my life to achieve certain things that were denied to me because of my gender, and I have achieved most of them with a tremendous effort. I have done 3 times the effort of any man to get half the recognition. So that has been very important in my life. I have to talk about that. I have to talk about that for myself and for other women too. I feel also that my generation of Latin American women were condemned to silence. There was a sort of conspiracy of silence for their work, their deeds, their goals. Whatever they achieved was always kept like in the attic. So I need to talk for those who are kept in silence.
I'm very curious about that work. What did it take? I'm thinking particularly of the Brazilian woman, Clarissa Lispector. An extraordinary writer. What did it take to be a writer, to assume a voice for her?
I don't know. For her, but for a woman of her generation in
yes.
Latin America, it takes, first of all, to assume that you're a bitch and you will be perceived as such, that you have to sacrifice part of what is supposed to be feminine, that is motherhood, being a wife, being the perfect housewife, all those things that your mother and your aunts and everybody else expects you to do, you will have to say, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to do something else. I'm going to lock myself in a room and write. Then you have to defy the establishment in order to get published. And once you are published, there's no way that you can get through the critics one by one who will say, they will accuse you of being sentimental if your book deals about emotions, of being a bitch if you don't, of being a hooker if you talk about sexuality than any man can talk about, and it wouldn't matter. Let me give you an example. There's a great, great book by Garcia Marquez, Love in Times of Cholera. It's a romantic story about two old people that fall in love. A woman in Latin America would have never been able to write that book because she would have been accused of everything. This is the kind of theme that only a person like Garcia Marquez can do, but no woman can afford it. So we have to be very careful about what we write, how we write, what the critics will say. There's I know writers who have written 8 works of fiction, won awards, and the first question that the interviewer, finally the interviewer when he comes over, asks is, why are you not wearing a bra? That is the kind of question a man never gets. You have to fight for every milligram of respect that you get.
And so then, are there things with your consciousness of being a woman writer that you will not say? Are you then creating a woman's literature that will, in a sense, alter present reality of women in the interest of the future reality of women?
I'm sorry, Margaret, but I don't plan things ahead. I don't have messages. I don't have answers. I only have questions, and I have a sort of naive approach to literature. I do the best I can with an open heart, and I get bad reviews. I get criticism. I get aggression very often, and it's okay. I can take it. And I wish I could somehow protect other women that are beginning. Tell them, don't be scared. Go ahead. Do it. It doesn't matter. If there's a critical number of us doing it, it will be accepted. Let's do it. But, of course, I'm 52. I can afford this because I don't give a damn. I have already lived my life. I'm not beginning anything, and I don't have any ambitions for the future. So I can afford it. But I wish I could protect other young writers.
I'm curious. If you could imagine a bookshelf belonging to a young woman, whose books would you put next to you? Would you like to see next to your own?
Oh, I would like to see all this sisterhood of women storytellers in the world. Not only the ones that I know from Latin America, but all these new voices and old voices of the United States, for example. African American, Chinese American, Japanese American, Chicanos, Native Indians, all those people that are writing with the old storytelling enthusiasm. I hate minimalist literature. I want strong stories. I want all these stories that relate us with the past, that keep alive traditions, memories, superstitions, myths, legends. I want all this to be in the same bookshelf.
Thank you. I've been speaking to Isabel Allende, the author most recently of Paula, published by HarperCollins. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
This has been part of a series called Imaging the Us, an exploration of autobiographical writing, which is a collaboration between Bookworm and the Getty Center for the History of Art and the Humanities. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. Special thanks to Roberto Bedoya of the Getty Center. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse clock time.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.